How do you think, I mean, this is an incredibly leading question, and you can strike me on that, but how do you think that the fact that the existence of gains for trade affects the way we should look at ideas such as exploitation and all of these other questions that tended to be raised when people talk about fair trade and protectionism?
The word exploitation is an interesting word because it really has two different meanings, and people tend to juggle between them in ways that I think are rhetorically dubious. One meaning is that I exploit you if I benefit by interacting with you. And in that sense, that's why we're social animals, why we're not cats, because I benefit by interacting with you, you benefit by interacting with me. I like to claim I exploit my students, that I hopefully teach them interesting things, and then I get them to write papers that teach me interesting things I didn't already know. But the other meaning of exploitation is that I benefit at your cost. And there's sort of an implicit assumption that somehow there's a fixed size pie and we're just fighting over it. And the trick is, if you blur those two, you can observe that an American firm is profiting by doing business in India, and aha, they're exploiting India. Well, that's right, they're making money out of India. So the people in India must be worse off. Doesn't follow, because after all, the people in India are making money off dealing with the Americans, and so we're both exploiting each other, would be. And that's typically what happens in any voluntary interaction, unless someone's made a mistake. But normally, you know, the reason I'm married to my wife is because I think I'm better off married to her than not, and I presume the reason she's married to me is she thinks she's better off married to me than not. You can describe that as mutual exploitation, but if you do, you've got to stop thinking of exploitation as a bad term and just as a description of benefiting from something, which we do. And as you may know, a lot of the discussion of trade in sort of modern terms is what I like to refer to as Ptolemaic economics. Anybody know who Ptolemy was? P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. Ptolemy was the Greek astronomer who was responsible for the theory of the nature of the universe that was dominant until the Copernican theory, until the picture of the sun with planets going around it. In the Ptolemaic theory, you have the Earth at the center, surrounded by a set of crystalline spheres with planets and stars embedded in it, and the spheres were turning around, and that's why the planets and the sun and the moon seem to go around us. And a lot of discussion of trade economics is done in terms of a set of economic ideas that are almost as obsolete as Ptolemaic astronomy. They were abandoned about a century after Ptolemy's ideas were abandoned. And that's the idea, what's sometimes referred to as absolute advantage, the idea that in trade, one country gains and one country loses. And this was part of what was referred to as mercantilism, and the sort of underlying mercantilist theory is, this was back when gold was used as money, and the theory is that if we sell you more than you sell us, then we get more of your gold than you get of ours. The more gold you have, the richer you are, and therefore we're getting richer, you're getting poorer. And this was a widely accepted theory up till about the late 18th century, maybe till the early 19th century. And it was wrong in lots of important ways, which you may have already studied if you've looked at the theory of comparative advantage, but it nonetheless lives on. Anytime anyone uses the term unfavorable balance of trade, he is 200 years out of date. Because the term unfavorable balance of trade implies that it is a bad thing if you are importing more than you're exporting. And the term favorable balance of trade implies it's a good thing if you are exporting more than you're importing. And that is that old idea about getting gold to flow into your country and assuming that somehow having piles of gold in your country made you rich. You can't eat gold. It doesn't taste very good. It makes pretty jewelry. But basically having lots of gold in your country does not actually mean you've got more bread and wine and clothes and other useful things. So that's sort of an interesting case where popular economics has not caught it. It's about 200 years behind. The theory of comparative advantage was worked out by David Ricardo, who was one of the really important founders of economics. He's sort of one of the brightest people ever in the field, I think. And has been, I would say, pretty generally accepted. And nonetheless, newspaper stories keep talking about favorable and unfavorable balance of trade, the trade deficit, as if that's sort of like the national deficit, or that's being worse off. What is balance of trade? Let me see if I can explain the idea. And let's start in a very simple world in which there are no capital movements, in which the only reason we want yen is to buy Japanese goods, and the only reason Japanese want dollars is to buy U.S. goods. And you then have a market between yen and dollars. All right? Some people want to buy yen with dollars. Some people want to buy dollars with yen. And just as in any other market, the price on that market, which is the rate at which the two currencies exchange, is going to move to the point at which the number of yen that we want to buy is the same as the number of yen they want to sell. Because as long as that's not the case, someone's going to bid it up or down. Is that sort of fairly straightforward stuff? People are already familiar with the idea. So that means you get that exchange rate at which Americans want to buy, want to sell as many dollars as Japanese want to buy, or alternatively, Americans want to buy as many yen as Japanese want to sell. Your transaction is doing both at the same time, selling dollars and buying yen, or vice versa. But what does that mean? It means that in that world, trade always balances, because why do the Japanese want dollars to buy U.S. goods? Why do we want yen to buy Japanese goods? So we must be buying as many dollars worth of their goods as we're selling to them. All right. So at that level of simplicity, there aren't any trade deficits, unless I suppose there could be some Japanese who collect dollars, and some very rich Japanese thinks it would be neat to paper his wall with paper dollars, so then you could have a little bit of a trade deficit because they'd be buying a few more dollars than they were actually using to buy stuff. But that's great because then he's giving us an interest-free loan because they're selling us goods and not getting goods in return. Maybe eventually his heirs will decide that they want to use those dollars for something other than wallpaper, and then they'll call in the loan and get the stuff back. Why is it that we don't have trade balancing? And the answer is basically capital movements. The simplest reason is that some of those Japanese want dollars not to buy Apple computers and ship them to Japan, but to buy shares of stock in Apple Computer Company and leave Apple Computer Company in the U.S. So basically, what a trade deficit really is a capital flow. And in the slightly less simple story I'm now telling, I've only got two countries, it gets a little more elaborate with more countries, the reason that we would have a trade deficit is that we are trading U.S. goods for Japanese goods and shares of U.S. stock for Japanese goods, that the Japanese are investing in the U.S. And in fact, if you look at U.S. history, you discover that in the 19th century, through a good deal of the century, the U.S. ran a trade deficit. And why did we run a trade deficit? Because European investors were building our canals and our railroads. They were investing in the bond issues of the companies that were building railroads and digging canals. And in order to do that, they needed dollars. In order to get those dollars, we had to buy their goods. All right. So the whole sort of standard pop version of trade theory is crazy. It's not crazy. It's only 200 years out of date. There's something else which is going on, and there are reasons why a trade deficit might be a bad thing. It depends what the capital is being used for. Because, of course, at the moment, another reason you might have a trade deficit is that what they're buying are not shares in Apple Computer Companies, but U.S. bonds. That is to say, the way in which the capital may be flowing in is that the U.S. government is borrowing very, very large amounts of money for the last couple of years. As you all know, we're running a very large deficit in the other sense, a budget deficit. In order to borrow lots of money, someone's got to lend it to you. If foreigners are lending you the money, that also will give you a trade deficit for the same reason. They're buying bonds or buying shares of stock. The machinery is exactly the same. All right. Is it a good or bad thing? Depends what you think the alternatives are. If the alternative is the government running the same budget deficit and borrowing the money for Americans, maybe it's a good thing. Maybe it means we've got more money left to invest in Apple Computer. If the alternative is the government not running a budget deficit, and you think a budget deficit is a bad thing, then it's too bad that we're borrowing money from the Chinese and the Japanese and whoever else is willing to lend it. But it isn't the trade deficit that's the problem. The trade deficit is just the, as it were, the accounting equivalent of the fact that we have an inflow of capital. And if we have an inflow of capital and are using it for useful things like building railroads and canals, that's good. If we're having an inflow of capital and are using it for undesirable activities, that's bad. But it isn't the trade deficit that's the problem. So I think that may get to at least some of your questions.
That's right. Any of us have questions?
Nobody has questions often. Let me say something.
Oh, go ahead.
I actually, at the same conference that he was just describing, I was one of the speakers, and my talk was about a book that I published a couple of years ago called Future Imperfect. And the book is an attempt to look at technological revolutions that might happen in about the next 30 years and what the world would look like as a result of those revolutions. And I guess, sort of insofar as there are any themes, the first theme is that everybody is much too conservative in their picture of the future. And I gave a talk on the book at Google a couple of years ago, and I sort of started out by saying the talk that I really thought that global warming was a pretty wimpy catastrophe. That, you know, in 100 years, the temperature of the Earth goes up a few degrees, sea levels go up a few feet. I've got three technologies that can wipe out the human race faster than that. And I do. Three technologies are artificial intelligence, nanotech, and biotech, as it happens. And each of those is something which could do very good things, could make the world a whole lot better place, or could do very bad things. And we can't easily predict what. We can try to think about what we can do to raise the odds one way and lower the odds the other. But there's a particular reason why it occurred to me when I was asked to talk here that that book had some relevance to your subject. Because one of the questions that arises when you start sketching possible technological revolutions, some of which could have very, very large effects, is maybe we should stop. Can we put on the brakes? Can we not do these things? And my usual answer is this particular train doesn't have brakes. And the reason it doesn't have brakes is international. The reason it doesn't have brakes is that we live in a world of many independent governments. So let me take an example of one of the potentially lethal technologies, and that's artificial intelligence. All right? I don't really know what I am, but the best guess I've got is that I'm software running on the hardware of my brain. That seems a closer model for what human beings seem to be than any other model anywhere. Suppose that's right. If that's right, then if we have good enough hardware and good enough software, we can have people in silicon as well as in carbon. We can have programmed computers. Any of you who read science fiction, this is an old idea. You can have programmed computers with human-level intelligence. And we can't do it today because we can't, in fact, build hardware that is as powerful as what every one of us has in his skull. But we're not getting any smarter, and our computers are getting faster. And so the projection that a number of reasonably thoughtful people have made is that in something like 30 years, we may well be able to produce programmed computers with human-level intelligence. And that's really sort of exciting and interesting. It's got a lot of attractive features. Won't go into it. Make a more interesting world to have some people who are utterly different from us, so to speak, to talk to. But there's just one downside. And that is that the computers keep getting smarter. So if in 30 years we have human-level computers, in 40 years we're gerbils. In 40 years we're sharing the planet with beings as much smarter than we are as we are smarter than gerbils, mice, things like that. And that's a scary idea. That's why that's one of my three technologies. Maybe they'll like pets and they'll take good care of us, but you can't count on it. And there's an interesting solution to this problem that Ray Kurzweil, the guy who invented the music synthesizer and a whole bunch of other important things, had. And his idea is that the way we avoid becoming gerbils is that we get good at mind-machine interfaces, at ways in which you can connect your mind directly to a computer, and then we start getting smarter and smarter too, because we're not just thinking in carbon now, we're doing some of our thinking in our own computers, and in effect, we become hybrid beings, part machine, part man. And presumably if it goes far enough, your brain and maybe your body is something you carry around for sentimental purposes, but really for most purposes you're a computer too. All right, let me go back and say what this has to do with global trade and stuff. It's a scary idea, all right? And you can easily enough imagine public sentiment as such things are developing, saying, no, you may not do any more research in AI, you can't make computers faster, because we don't want to be gerbils. It's not an absurd kind of argument. On the other hand, at each step of the process, the slightly smarter computer is very, very useful. It results in you making money on the stock market because you can predict market change is better. It results in you're doing a better job of analyzing human genes to figure out how to make people healthier and smarter and stuff like that. If you're fighting a war, probably your computer can help you fight the war and so forth. So there's always an incentive for somebody to make a somewhat better computer, somewhat better AI software. If we had a one-world government, which I hope we will not have, but if we had a one-world government, that government maybe could say, all right, if you do research in this field, we'll shoot you. And maybe they could stop the research, but we don't. And as long as we've got lots of independent centers, unless all of them suppress the technology, none of them suppress the technology. Does that make sense? Because once, if it's a useful technology, once somebody has it, other people are going to copy it. So in this case, I've been arguing for some time that one of the really exciting things about the century that you people are going to see more of than I will is that for about the last 300 years, all that really mattered was European civilization. America is European civilization. We just, you know, carried it across the Atlantic. And the first crack in that was Japan. Japan was the first clearly non-Western civilization, which in the course of the 20th century became a player, started doing things at the same level of technological sophistication as the developed countries, as they demonstrated rather dramatically on December 7th of a good many years ago when they blew up a good deal of the U.S. fleet. It's happening for a bunch more. That what part of what's happening at the moment and will be happening through this century is the other old civilizations coming back online. So we are going to see what a developed, technologically sophisticated, more or less capitalist Chinese civilization looks like. And Indian civilization. Maybe several Indian civilizations. India is a pretty diverse place, as some of you may know. Maybe Indonesia. Maybe Brazil. Maybe the Islamic world if they finally get their act together. The nice thing about that, as long as everything is European, all of the countries regulating things have about the same prejudices. So as long as everything is European, if the Americans think some technology is dangerous and want to suppress it, probably the English think so, and the German think so, and the French think so, and then there's no place to do it. But if we have a world where multiple civilizations have developed technological societies, none of them may be any better than we are in terms of believing in, you know, freedom for developing stuff, but they'll all be different. And so America will suppress AI, but China will think that's great. Japan will suppress aging research, but Indonesia will think it's great. And the reason, that's why I say that the train has no brakes. That can be a good or a bad thing. I mean, if you read my book, which is available for free online, if you want. In fact, I should give you my webpage if you want to read it. I discuss both downside and upside features of technologies. But on the whole, I'm an optimist. And I'd like to live for several hundred years, which I'm not going to do without some considerable improvements in our treatment of aging. So the book is called Future Imperfect, and it's webbed there. You can also buy it from Amazon, but if you're feeling cheap, feel free to just read it online, where it's free. Anyway, so I guess the point I'm making is that part of what's going to be important about international stuff is that as big technologies develop, they're going to develop in different places at different speeds, because some governments, and for that matter some cultures, are going to be hostile to certain technologies and try to suppress them, but somewhere else in the world you've got the opposite attitude. And that's going to make it an interesting place. It's going to mean that if you're engaged in international trade, one of the things you want to ask yourself is, where is something happening that I could sell in the U.S.? Let me take a real-world example, for me a very real-world example indeed, and that is human reproductive technology, and in particular within human reproductive technology, the use of host mothers. As it happens, my first granddaughter was born about a month ago in India from a rented womb, from an egg and a sperm provided by my adult son and his wife. My grandson, their first child, was born very premature, and if he had been born 30 years earlier, he would be dead, but we're much better at treating premature kids than we were, and they decided that this time they better use somebody whose body was more competent at producing babies than my daughter-in-law's was. So that's a case. Now, that's a very interesting case, because various countries try to put pressure against that kind of thing, against going abroad because it's a lot cheaper to hire an Indian mother to bear your baby than to hire an American mother, and Indian mothers are just as good at bearing babies as American mothers, which is why there are so many Indians, presumably. And some countries, there was a case, I think, recently where I think they were German or something, and they wouldn't let them and the baby back into the country. And in the case of my son and his wife, there were no laws against it, but there was a good deal of sort of bureaucratic hassle involved in the process. But that's a case where you have a technology which is very useful to some individuals and which some other people find offensive for one reason or another. It's sort of the idea that you're exploiting these poor people by offering them what, from their standpoint, is a good wage to spend 9 months bearing your baby. And yet it's going to keep happening. It's going to go a good deal further. That is, the host mother is, in a sense, the easiest version. The next more controversial one, which is already going on, is gender selection by selective abortion. As you probably know, in both India and China, you have societies where many people would rather have a son than a daughter. And now you can do it, because now the way they do that is you test early on whether the fetus is male or female, and if it's the wrong kind, you abort. This is not a new process. It's just a little bit faster. 2,000 years ago, they did it by exposing female infants, right? That was the Greek and I think the Roman approach, that if you didn't want certain kind of infants, you waited till they were born, you looked to see what they were, and then you left them out on a hillside somewhere to die if you didn't like them. But selective abortion is the modern version, and we're going to be able to do better than that, because increasingly, especially with in vitro fertilization, which is what host mothers do, you've got the option of checking the what's referred to as the pre-embryo, which really is just a very, very early stage embryo before you implant it, and then you never bear the thing past the 8-cell version if it's what you don't want. And of course, gender selection, which is controversial for perfectly legitimate reasons, you can see why people are worried about what happens if you have a society that's, you know, 6 men to every 5 women or whatever. But that's just an early version, because, of course, once we get good at this, you're going to be able to produce those pre-embryos, do a genetic analysis, and say, all right, this one carries the father's genes for bad hearts. We don't want this one. That one carries the mother's low blood pressure genes. We don't want that one. But this one has got all of the good, not all, but many of the good features, and both of them, that's the one we want to implant. And it's going to go further than that. How many of you read science fiction? Very few. Any Heinlein? Robert Heinlein, in one of his first novels, and one of his least good novels, I should say, as a story, but it's got lots of neat ideas in it, it got much better later, has what I refer to as libertarian eugenics. And the idea is that if there is a way of, in effect, analyzing the genetics of sperm and egg before they combine, then you can, in effect, provide a service for parents where you select out the sperm that carries the desirable characteristics of the father and not the undesirable ones, the egg that carries the characteristics you want of the mother and not the undesirable ones, combine those together, you now have the fertilized egg which will give you your perfect baby. Not a perfect baby, only my babies are perfect, but almost perfect baby. Anyway, so I'm really, as I say, the point I'm trying to make, and there are lots of other technologies, just happens to be one I've been immediately involved with since I met my granddaughter about 4 or 5 days ago when they got back finally from India. But there are going to be a lot of cases, I think, over the next few decades where one or another use of technology is unpopular in some places, accepted in other places, and if you're engaged in international trade, that's one of the things to pay attention to. You know, there are going to be limits to it. You're going to find in some cases that if you want to import a technology that's sufficiently unpopular in the U.S., you'll get arrested doing it. But there are going to be lots of marginal cases. There will be lots of cases where you can say, well, we can't import this technology into the U.S., but it's a medical technology, and we can export the patients. If somebody in China or India or Japan or Indonesia has got a cure for aging, all right, I have a chapter on aging in my book, and I call it The Last Lethal Disease, because that's the one we're all dying of. And I know of no good reason to believe that it's incurable. That is, I can't think of any good theoretical reason why, if you make enough progress in human biology, you couldn't be able to keep people from getting older. And you can discuss that if people are curious. but you can certainly see why some people might be unhappy with the idea, especially the people running Social Security system, for example, which goes bankrupt if people don't die of old age. But also people worried about population. And there are people, it seems to me very bizarre, but there are people who sort of say it's the nature of man to grow old and die, and it's sort of a violation of the natural laws. It's somehow intuitively evil to stop growing old and die. This is done by people who are what's called bioethics, and bioethicists are basically people who believe that you should die for their ethics. Because, yeah.
I'm just curious, how do you think if technology advanced enough, the medical technology,
yep,
we wouldn't age, because everything has wear. Even if it doesn't age itself, it still has wear.
But you may not have noticed, but you are a machine that repairs itself. You cut yourself and those cells grow back.
Mm-hmm.
What's critical is information, the information for designing and redesigning your body. That information is present in every cell of your body. You're talking about a library with, I don't know what the current estimate is, but certainly over a trillion copies. It's very hard to lose information if you've got a trillion books. So any piece of you can wear out. Piece of you are continually wearing out. All right, your fingernails. You don't have the same fingernails you had a year ago. But they're still functional. They just keep growing. And so, we're self-repairing. There aren't any young amoebas. All right, amoebas reproduce by dividing. They don't die and get born. So any amoeba that's running around here somewhere, rather small, so a little hard to see, he's very, very old indeed. So I can't see any inherent reason. Now, the question of why we do grow old is an interesting question. There are a variety of different theories of why organisms, in fact, age. And it might turn out that it's a very hard problem. I'm not saying that there's any guarantee we'll solve it, but I can't see how it can be an impossible problem if you just think of the logic of it. Anyway, let's see. There are a bunch of other technologies I could talk about. I have a list of them here, but I think at this point I should stop for a minute and see if people have additional questions, whether about what I've just been talking about or about global trade or anything else that occurs to you. Anybody? Nobody? Getting me to stop talking is a real achievement. You should take advantage of it while it happens. All right. Let me talk about an entirely different technology, but one which also is going to be relevant to foreign trade, I think, in an interesting way. How many people here know what public key encryption is? One person. All right. Suppose you want to send a secret message to somebody, which is something people have wanted to do for some thousands of years for various reasons. And the sort of standard approach is that you have some formula for scrambling your message, which is called the key. Which describes how you're going to scramble and unscramble your message. And you send a copy of the key to the person you want to communicate with. And then every time you send a message, you scramble the message, he unscrambles it. Somebody in the middle without the key can't read what you sent him. And there's a serious problem with this approach. And that is that if you don't have a safe way of getting your messages to him, you may not have a safe way of getting the key to him. And if the trusted messenger who took the key to him really deserved the trust of somebody other than you, now whoever the enemy is who you're afraid might be reading your mail has a copy of the key and he can decrypt the messages to you. And this problem was solved by a mathematical breakthrough, I suppose, by now almost about 40 years ago, called public key encryption. And it's a mathematical process in which you produce two keys, two long numbers that have a rather complicated relation to each other, such that if you scramble a message with one key, you need the other key to unscramble it. All right? That's why it's called, that's why it's a two-key system, double-key encryption. What does that mean? I create this pair of numbers, and I label one of them my public key and one of them my private key. And my public key, I broadcast to the world. I give a copy of that to everybody who wants it. You want to send me a message? It's really simple. You encrypt your message with my public key. I decrypt it with my private key. She wants to spy on us. She has my public key. That's great. She can send me secret messages too. But my public key won't decrypt the messages that you're sending me, and therefore I don't have to worry about keeping it secret. I only have to keep my private key secret. So this is a technology which has the virtue that it doesn't require a government that can send military attachés around with briefcases handcuffed to their wrists to exchange secret information. It means that perfectly ordinary people can have online conversations that the National Security Agency and the FBI can't read. It turns out that this particular technology gives us some other benefits as well, because it also gives us identity. I'm corresponding with you, and you'd like to be sure you're talking to the person who I claim to be. As long as you know what my public key is, as long as you know that David Friedman's public key is da 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 da, I can send you a message encrypted with my private key. You decrypt it with my public key, and the fact that what you get is not gibberish means it must have been encrypted with the matching private key, which only David Friedman has. So that gives, that's the guts of how digital signatures work. And that gives you a way of establishing identity at a distance. It doesn't have to be real space identity. Suppose I want to create an online persona with a reputation and not tell anybody who he is. My standard version of this is, suppose I want to practice law in the state of California. I have not passed the bar. I have not been to law school. I am not legally allowed to practice law in the state of California. I'm also not competent to do it as it happens. But suppose I were. I set up a web page called Legal Eagle Online. And I give away free legal advice for 6 months in order to prove to people that I give them good legal advice. And then I start selling it. Somebody else decides to try to steal my reputation, and he sets up a Legal Eagle Online too, except he can't digitally sign with Legal Eagle signature because that depends on my public key. And one of the first things I did when I set up Legal Eagle Online was to put the public key up on the website so that even before my reputation was established, people had my public key and could check my. What does this mean? It means we have a technology which allows you to simultaneously have anonymity and reputation. You can have an online identity which has a reputation without anyone else in the world knowing whether you're male or female, 70 or 15, or what continent you live on. It's an enormously powerful technology for good and for evil. For the evil part, let me give you my business plan for Murder Incorporated. Suppose you wanted to kill somebody. Most, you know, many of us get irritated from time to time. The reason it's not practical to hire a contract killer is not the price. For most of us, maybe how rich any of you are. But as far as I can tell from news stories, the cost of a hitman is less than the cost of a car. And most, at least most adult Americans can afford a car. The reason it's not practical to hire a hitman, or at least very dangerous, is that you don't have access to a reliable seller of that service, and you're therefore quite likely to end up in jail while trying to hire one. This problem we can solve. You set up an online firm, Murder Incorporated. It first publicizes its public key before anybody knows what that is. It then commits some very highly publicized murders. I'm not sure a politician would be important enough, but I figure maybe a bomb at the Academy Awards would get people's attention. It arranges to make it clear it's what did those murders, and now it tells you how to get messages to it. And so now you want to hire a hitman, you correspond with him. Oh, I left out one technology. The other critical technology that public key encryption gives us is fully anonymous digital cash. It turns out that there are known ways in which one can set up online money such that I can make a payment to you by sending you a message. I don't have to know who you are, only how to get a message to you. You don't have to know who I am. And the bank that's ultimately holding the money doesn't have to know who either of us is. If people are curious, I could discuss a little bit of ways you can do that. But the critical thing is that we, in fact, know how to do that. So once you've got a fully anonymous digital cash, now you can pay for your hitman with digital cash. Now, there are attractive features as well. In particular, public key encryption gives you freedom of speech that does not depend on the views of the Supreme Court. Because if they can't see you, they can't arrest you. So it's a very powerful tool for reducing the power of governments. And that's a bad thing when the governments are trying to keep people from committing murder. And it's a good thing when the governments are trying to suppress speech and do various other things that we'd rather they not do. And those of us who think that governments are much more often the problem than the solution will regard as on net a good thing. Those who look and see it the other way will regard it as net the bad thing. But that doesn't matter if all you want to do is understand it. You want to say, this is going to make certain things possible. Now, the interesting thing about anonymous digital cash is it only has to be done once by one firm. That it doesn't exist yet. We know how to do it. The reason it doesn't exist, I think, is that the governments of major countries don't want it to exist. Because, of course, one thing that happens once you have anonymous digital cash is that money laundering laws become utterly unenforceable. All right, they're just paper. In order to have your digital cash, you have to have a bank somewhere that people trust, in some respectable place, as it were. And governments can make it hard for that to happen. But the more diverse the world is, the more you've got countries that the U.S. and its allies can't push around, the more likely it is that one of those countries is going to see some business opportunities in setting up a bank which provides anonymous digital cash for the rest of the world. And again, you could go in, I discuss it in more detail in the book if you're curious about how you do it. So that's another one of these things where stuff abroad could end up being very important indeed. Let's see. Other technologies I could talk about if people want to talk about technologies. One of them is nanotechnology, which you may or may not have heard about, but which is one of these science fiction things that could turn out to be true, and which incidentally, among other things, could be the solution to living forever. How many people here know what the term nanotechnology refers to? It's basically... Literally, it's just a technology of very small things. But the interesting thing, molecular nanotechnology, is the idea of building machines at the atomic level. That things like this, which we think of as really sophisticated, all of those parts are made out of billions or trillions or quadrillions of atoms. On the other hand, there are sitting in this room about 20 machines that are engineered at the atomic level. Me and you and you and you and you. All living creatures. If you think about how our innards work, the enzymes, proteins, DNA, RNA, these are basically molecules whose structure makes stuff happen. So we're engineered, in effect, atom by atom, by evolution rather than by human engineers. We are gradually approaching the ability to do it, to build machines by putting an atom here and an atom here and an atom here and an atom there. If you can do it, there are enormously useful as well as enormously dangerous things one can imagine doing with it. The first thing you, in order to get nanotech really going, you need one step, and that is to build what's referred to as a general purpose assembler. And a general purpose assembler is a little molecular scale robot factory that you can give instructions to, and the instructions are take atom A and attach it to atom B, repeat, etc. So that a general purpose assembler is a general purpose factory for building things at the atomic scale. Suppose you have a general purpose assembler. What's the first thing you build with it? You got it. A general purpose. And once you've got two general purpose assemblers, what do you build with them? Two more general purpose assemblers. So what that means is that once you've got one, then you've got an unlimited number. That remember that at the atomic scale, the world consists of identical parts called atoms. Think of it as Legos, very small Legos. So as far as your assembler is concerned, it's swimming in bunch of carbon atoms, hydrogen atoms, whatever you've provided for it, and it can pick up this and put it there, and so forth. So once you've got a quadrillion assemblers, let us say, and good enough computer software to do the design work, you build a car. And this is not an ordinary car. The windshield of this car is made out of diamond, because diamond is very hard, and if you can put carbon atoms one at a time, you can build things out of diamond and structure them so it doesn't shatter very easily, and so forth. And you can do a whole lot of other interesting things. And the really neat thing is that once you've got the design for the car, and you can transmit it over a really, really high-speed internet, because it's going to be a very long design, then if I've got an assembler, which means I've got a quadrillion assemblers very quickly, I dig a hole in the backyard, and I dump in some of this and some of that. The Earth is, I guess aluminum is one of the most common elements in the Earth, and I dump in a gallon of gasoline so that my assembler would work, I could disassemble for energy, and I dump in the assemblers, and the next morning there's my shiny car sitting in a hole in the ground. All right? Because you think that's impossible. How do you think they build oak trees? All right? An oak tree is a piece of nanotech stuff, a living creature, and you start out with an acorn, which has got the design for an oak tree in it. Its energy input is sunlight, and it's got a bunch of stuff, and it pulls the relevant atoms out of the ground, and there is an oak tree. We can probably do it faster with a little practice. So a very powerful technology, interesting in a whole lot of ways, which I'm not going to go into. But it's got certain downsides. Upside. The upside is that you design a very, very small robot cell, or a robot submarine, and your very small robot submarine is so small that it's much smaller than a cell. And what is its job? It's to go through your cells fixing everything that's wrong. Now, it's true it will take a very long time to get every cell, but that's all right, because once we've got our assemblers, we can make as many cell repair machines as we like. And once there are enough of them, you swallow a pill, and these cell repair machines go through your body, and they report back, boss, all right, I took out 3 potential cancers, and opened up some arteries, and there was an aging effect on certain cells, and I eliminated that. We're done. All right? So that's another path to live forever, maybe. On the other hand, let's suppose that somebody designs a nano device, which uses readily available elements, gets its energy from sunlight, and has as its sole purpose turning everything in the environment into copies of itself. This is referred to as the gray goo scenario in nanotech circles, because the idea is that if somebody creates this thing, pretty soon the entire world, not the universe, because not being into space, but everything else is gray goo, and that's not a very pleasant idea. So that's why people worry. That's why nanotech is in my list of technologies that could wipe us out, as well as technologies that could make the world a whole lot better, and how you get one to say that the other is an interesting problem. You will find a discussion of that in my book as well. So that's one of the neat technologies. Let me give another technology. How many people here play World of Warcraft? I'm willing to admit it, I should say. Me too. Think about virtual reality. All right? There's no particular reason why I had to fly from San Jose to Southern California in order to give a talk yesterday and to sit in front of this class. You could imagine doing the same thing by my staying in San Jose, and you all have goggles on, and I've got goggles on, and to you, you see me sitting here and hear me, even though I'm really in San Jose, and I see all of you sitting here, even though you're here and I'm really in San Jose, because the goggles are drawing the pictures for our eyes, showing what we do. That's virtual reality. And it's a very interesting potential technology, because if it gets good enough, most of the things people want are a large fraction, at least, are really sensory inputs. That if you have good enough virtual reality, you eat soybean mush and it tastes like steak, or Baskin Robbins ice cream, or sushi, or whatever you happen to like. But it's better for you. Short of that, you can interact with people far away. You can climb Mount Everest without getting cold. You can do all sorts of interesting things. And a few years back when I wrote about this and thought about it, the idea was this becomes really important when you have a little bit of higher technology, so that instead of just looking at a computer screen, you could have goggles and some way of getting feeling, touch, and temperature and all the rest of it. It turned out I was wrong. It turns out what you need is the really high technology, which is the human imagination. That's World of Warcraft. We've been doing it for several thousand years. Homer did it too. He didn't have a screen, he didn't have speakers, but he still got us to watch, follow Odysseus around the Mediterranean. So with the combination of the technology we all have of a screen and speaker and the imagination, you could be spending chunks of your life in Azeroth instead of on Earth. All right? And if you think of what happens as that goes on, and of course World of Warcraft is only one of a variety of competing activities, you could imagine a world where the virtual world you're spending your time in is more important to you than the immediate physical world, where your real friends, your sort of companions, are a group of 50 people, of whom 3 of them happen to live in Chile and 2 of them in Canada and 1 in China, but you don't even know that. It's completely irrelevant because they all happen to speak English, because English is becoming the international language, and you're all interacting on a screen where they're all present. For a while, my daughter, who's now 20, her not-boyfriend, as everyone in the family described it, was a man a few years older than she was in Chile, who none of us had ever met, including her, of course. And eventually, he happened to be visiting the U.S. and spent a week with us. He's a very nice young man, but he's still her not-boyfriend, because it turned out that we wanted to be friends, but it looked like anything beyond that. We'll see what happens. He does have dual citizenship, which might simplify matters if it does go further. In any case, my point really is that virtual reality really changes our world in an important way, because it means that geographical location becomes less and less important. The Internet's already doing that, but the Internet is a somewhat narrow version of that. So you may well be growing up in a world in which the question of what country does he live in is just not a very important question when you're dealing with people, whether you're dealing with them as friends or whether you're dealing with them commercially as employers, employees, co-workers, whatever. And that's going to be very interesting. You may be living in a world of virtual firms where most firms have no real physical location at all. They just are a network of people who are communicating with each other. It occurred to me a while ago that really the very largest virtual reality phenomenon was the one that everybody takes for granted, namely cell phones. It used to be, even 15 years ago, if I saw somebody walking down the street holding a conversation with nobody there, I assume he's crazy. I mean, that's the only interpretation. Nowadays, I know perfectly well he's got a Bluetooth thing in his ear and he's having a cell phone conversation. But what does that cell phone conversation mean? It means that in a very real sense, he and somebody 300 miles away are next to each other. They're talking to each other. That's VR. It's just a narrow bandwidth version of VR, but it's still VR.
Is he a gamer?
No.
It's the same concept you just mentioned with the virtual reality, but the thing about it is if you're in your virtual reality, you can also get killed in your virtual reality.
And you stay dead or not?
You stay dead, yes.
Yeah. One of the nice things about World of Warcraft is you don't stay dead. But yeah, it's worth thinking about what that world would be. Let me go on for a moment. The next step in virtual reality, which we may or may not ever take, is what I think of as cracking the dreaming problem. That there's a sense in which we all experience a full sense virtual reality many nights when you're asleep dreaming and you're seeing things. Suppose we knew enough about how the human brain worked so that we could simulate that. So instead of having a screen and speakers, you've got a cable plugging into the back of your neck, and it is sending appropriate signals into your brain, which your brain interprets as, I'm standing on a mountaintop looking around, I'm turning my head, I'm seeing things, I'm feeling things, and so forth. And at that point, you get a really interesting world, which looked at in one dimension as dirt poor, because after all, everybody's eating soybean mush, what's the point of, or whatever else is nutritious, what's the point of having sushi when you can have virtual sushi? And everybody's living in a little cubicle because, after all, you've got an estate on the Pacific coast. That's where you're spending your time, virtually speaking. And you're getting your exercise by pushing resistance things in a bed or something. And yet your mind is wandering this world where everybody is phenomenally rich and everyone is beautiful. And if they want to be, they don't have to be ugly if you like being ugly. And you can interact with people. You can have all the ice cream you want, never get fat, because it's all soybean mush, appropriate quantities, and so forth. So, you know, is that habit or health? And it's sort of an interesting question. Does achieving things in virtual reality really count? Should you feel satisfied if you've done really neat things in World of Warcraft but haven't done anything in the real world? Well, I'm not sure that doing really neat things in World of Warcraft is any less real than winning a bridge tournament or even a tennis tournament. That, in a certain sense, all of those are just things done for their own sake. Not, but it is true that if you make food in World of Warcraft, it won't really feed anybody. So some element of the real world has to still be there in order that our physical bodies can survive. Other comments, questions, things people want to talk about? Getting to the answer about when the class is supposed to end?
Well, no, we have another hour.
We have another hour. We're talking at 5. So. But again, questions, things people would like to talk about?
I'm sorry, what's your introduction?
What is my occupation? I am an academic economist who teaches at a law school, has a doctorate in theoretical physics, and has never taken an economics course for credit in my life. So I do lots of things. And
yourself taught?
Yeah, I suppose. Economics was the family field, so I sort of grew up knowing a lot about it. And when I had my first job as an economist, I think the person who was sort of the de facto dictator of the department quietly arranged to have me teach more or less every course in the syllabus, and that's a great way of learning stuff. Now when I came to VPI as an assistant professor of economics, one of my colleagues, Gordon Tullock, used to say that he had published more pages of economics than had been assigned in all of the economics courses he had taken. And so I told him that I achieved that with my first page. So, anyway. But if you go on my webpage, you can find lots of things. You can find Future Imperfect. You can find my first book, which is a libertarian treatise that I wrote in 1971, roughly, of which one part, the most interesting part, is a sketch of what a society might look like which had private property and law but no government, which I'm trying to imagine really privatizing things. That is taking, if you think about sort of the general issue of schooling is something can be done by government, it can be done privately. Growing food can be done by government, done privately. How about preventing crime? Well, in fact, more people are in the business of preventing crime privately than government. If you think about all of the security guards and the people who make burglar alarms and all the rest of it, it comes to about three times the number of government law enforcement people. How about settling disputes? What courts do? Well, there's an awful lot of private arbitration out there. And so I try to see, what if you carried it all the way? What if you eliminated the government and had a society that was both anarchist and capitalist at the same time? And that was sort of what the third section of that book was about, and I thought it was sort of fun and interesting to do. But other things I've got, there are two novels up there, one of which was actually published commercially by a respectable publisher, and the second one I haven't found a publisher, so I just put it up on the web for people to read. They're fun, I hope, and people can read those. If you have historical interests, I have hundreds of medieval recipes, because my wife and I have the hobby of cooking from very old cookbooks, which is neat. You can look at those. I've got some of my poetry up there. Lots of other things up there.
Do you think we'll ever have a world like a Brave New World or 1984? Do you think we'll ever get to that point?
Those are not very attractive stories. Yeah. Well, we had 1984. I mean, Soviet Russia had it for quite a while, more or less. Not in detail, but... I go back and forth on optimism versus pessimism, that, you know, because most of the time the world is going in all directions at once, that some things are getting worse and some things are getting a whole lot better. Let me give you an example that won't have occurred to you about things getting worse. Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776. It was sort of, I suppose, the most famous early book in economics. And one of the things he discusses is possible taxes. What are ways in which the government might collect money? And he considers the possibility, if I remember, of, I think it's both an income tax and either a wealth tax or a sales tax, I forget what it is. And he says, no, this just is not a practical alternative. You couldn't have an income tax. Because in order to have an income tax, you would have to have an inquiry into people's private affairs, not once, but renewed every year, that no free people would put up with. All right, so that's the direction in which we move backward, at least if he's right, that in that sense, our standards are lower than they were then of privacy and independence. At the same time, when he was writing, there was still slavery, and the law still was that in law, husband and wife are one person, and that person is the husband. There are a lot of unattractive things about that world, as well as some attractive things about that world. And I think on net, we're quite a lot better off than we were then. But, you know, year by year, some things get better, some things get worse. And when I'm in a good mood, I think we're getting towards a freer and richer society, and maybe I'll get to live forever, or at least for the first 400 or 500 years. And when I'm in a worse mood, I see it the other way. Let me just do something to think about. Suppose we did end aging. Suppose you could be permanently your present age if you wanted to be, or maybe age a little bit more if you like that. What kind of a life would you live? What would you do with the next 300 years, say? Didn't have that at our back we ever hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity, the grave's a fine and private place, but none I hear do there embrace, from a famous seduction poem from about the 17th century or so. Therefore, come go to bed with me now, basically, is the bottom line of it, to his coy mistress by Andrew Marvel. But it's still a neat description of the fact that we're all facing, you know, death coming up at the far end.
Our resources would deplete more naturally unless, you know, one of the nanos
expands. For a moment, the question I'm asking is not what would the world be like. That's one interesting question. But at the individual level, what life would you...
I personally wouldn't feel as strong a need to actually accomplish things, because I would have, like, a lot of times, like, oh, well, I have, you know, 100 more years to actually go and get married.
So you'd have a real opportunity for procrastination. That's certainly one possibility. Of course, you might also have longer-term projects. You might also say, well, you know, I've got this idea, but I could never get it finished until it started, but now it could go either way. No, I agree. That's certainly a possibility. How about children? Suppose you as presumably many of you, where you get married, you have a family, you bring them up, they're adults, they go off, they get married. Do you want to do it again? You think once would be enough?
Depends on how the first one's turned out.
Mine turned out wonderfully. I only produce wonderful children. Let me explain about this. You see, I happen by pure good fortune to have the world's most wonderful children. And that sounds really scary, because that ought to mean that all the other parents would want to steal my children from me. But by even greater good fortune, all the other parents are so prejudiced that they think they have the world's most wonderful children, so they don't go after mine. But anyway, so suppose you're happy with how the kid, I mean, they don't have to be perfect. Suppose you're on the whole, as I am, in fact, happy how my kids have turned out. Would you do it again, or would you say, well, look, they're going to provide me grandchildren. I still have little kids to cuddle. I've got other things to do. I have, bringing up kids is an awful lot of work. Any guesses?
Presumably depend a lot on personal preferences.
Yeah. Part of the reason I ask is going back to your issue of what happens to the world, that if each person only has one family, population goes up, but it goes up linearly, just because people aren't dying. If you keep on having it, then as there are more people, there are also more children being born, and then it goes up exponentially. So as it happens, I think that most worries about population and resources are greatly overdone. So my guess is that if it's just moving linearly, we got technological improvement as well, making us richer, we're probably all right. If it goes up exponentially, I think you've got serious problems. And that's why partly I'm curious as to which way people would actually react in that case. But what about the individual life? Suppose, presumably most of you expect to have a career of some sort. So suppose you end up getting a job, you know, doing foreign trade or as lawyers or doctors or businessmen or whatever, and you've spent, you know, 30 or 40 years, you're a reasonably successful person and you had it. Do you say, well, I know how to do this, I can get paid for things, I'll do it forever? Or do you say, this was interesting, but it's getting sort of boring now. I think I'm going to go back to school and become an engineer or a novelist or something else. Or do you maybe say, you know, working for a living isn't that bad, but it's got its downside. What I'm going to do is to live on the lowest income I can and make as much money as I can for another 20 or 30 years, and then I'm going to retire forever.
But it goes back to what she was saying. Our motivation for doing anything is knowing that our time is going to come to an end. I mean, if we want to leave an impact on the world before we leave the world. So you can't completely exclude that. You know, what is your motivation to go back to school? You're here forever.
Yeah, but, yeah.
I would tend to disagree with that because definitely we can think because we enjoy them or because we need to do them primarily. I don't think many people are as morbid as I might be and think about the limited time left in our life.
Putting it differently, most of the things we do are things we expect to complete long before we die. So that most of the things we do really aren't constrained by that. Some things are, obviously. I mean, there are some projects where you really say, I mean, you know, I've written this novel, and I've got the beginning of a sequel, which I abandoned to write a different novel, and I actually have plans for a 3-book series, and that's the sort of thing where I start thinking, you know, am I going to live long enough to get back to that project and do it? But most projects, it seems to me most of us have, are really projects for a year or 5 years or 10 years, and only a few of them are for a lifetime. But some of them are for a lifetime, that's true. And I can see either way. I can see either the person who says, but look, it's more worth doing this project because I get to see how it turns out. I get to live in the world I've improved. And I get to keep building it, maybe, you know, whatever the... Or I can see, as you say, the person who says, I'm going to procrastinate forever.
You do live longer, you do have to maintain a living for a longer time, so you do need to specialize in some type of trade because there still is, you know, monetary exchange to make time.
Yep. Yeah. But you may have the option, if you're willing to make the sacrifices for a while, of accumulating enough money so you can live on your interest. And you could, that what seems to me in some ways the most attractive is to accumulate enough so you can live a tolerable life without working. And then you take jobs when there's a fun, interesting job that presents itself. And if not, you know, you decide to eat beans instead of steak for a little while and, you know, spend your time in the public library instead of in Disneyland and until the next good job comes around. Yeah.
For me personally, I think just the value of things would mean a lot less. Like, the longer I live, things would have a lot less meaning. Like, I wouldn't find any point to, say, go and buy a car because, I mean, by that point, I've probably seen everything.
The car is still useful.
Yes, but I probably wouldn't say... vital. I might decide, since I have, you know, an extra 100 years, walking somewhere and say, like, taking an hour to walk somewhere versus getting somewhere in, like, 5 minutes, it's a big
might
difference
be.
Because time is not, it doesn't really matter.
Might be. Although still, you still get bored in an hour, at least I would. But,
well, yeah.
But yeah, yes. No, I mean, I think this is sort of part of, let me put a different question. That is, old people are different. Why are old people different? Are old people different because of the physiological changes of old age, or are they different because they've lived a long time? So, is it that just the accumulation of experience changes you? In which case you might be, as it were, more blasé, more careful, a bunch of things like that, things we associate with old people. Or is it that they're like that only because of physical breakdown, which we associate with, you know, gray hairs and that stuff, and we didn't have that, we'd all be young and cheerful and, you know, innovative. One version of that, related to this, is there are some fields, such as mathematics, where the great people tend to do their work quite young. And so an interesting issue is, suppose you took somebody who had done great work in mathematics when he was 20, and he's now 35, and he really, you know, he can still teach, he can still, you know, but he's not doing any creative work. Suppose you retrained him into molecular biology, would he suddenly do another wave of great work? Is it being old, or is it being new? And I don't know what the answer to that is.
You have more flexibility to attain more trades and skills. Like, you know, you can switch industry, you know.
And some things you could do better. There's a not bad science fiction author who used to be a Marine officer, Elizabeth Moon. And I presume that having been a Marine officer is an asset for writing science fiction. It means you've had certain experiences, you know, certain parts of life that you otherwise wouldn't know. So it might be interesting to see the novels that will be written by somebody who had lived 5 or 6 different lives, in effect, and had all of that accumulated experience. Yep.
Also, like, if you were living for such a long amount of time, wouldn't genetics be so much more important? Like, what the genetics of your parents were and people that came before you, because that's going to be basically the only differences that are between us, because we can technically learn anything that someone else has already learned.
Yeah, it might be, although to some extent some of the genetic difference is how fast you learn stuff, and therefore maybe the longer time you have, the lesser it is. One of the things that irritated me some time ago about being a professor is that there are rules that you're probably familiar with which say that if a student presents the right paperwork to claim that he or she is learning disabled, you have to give them extra time on an exam. And that bothers me, because though some of those people may really be people who need the extra time, some of them are just people who knew the right psychiatrist as it were to write the right paper. And so I said, what can I do about this? I don't like to feel that I'm helping people cheat. And so what I could do about this was to revise my exams so that most people finished them, so that having an extra hour didn't matter. And thinking about it, I decided that I probably should have revised my exams that way anyway, because I'm very fast, and I think I was giving too much weight to can you answer the question quickly relative to can you answer it right. And in that sense, with more time, being able to do things quickly becomes somewhat less important, so that we just wanted the genetic differences, I suspect, among people. But yeah, genetics, of course, is another big, I mean, I mentioned that earlier, and that's sort of one of the technologies where you can easily enough imagine a world where some sorts of genetic stuff are illegal in some countries, but where people are going on the black market or going out of the country to do them, or going to offshore hospitals or something. That, as you may or may not know, there are basically two kinds of genetic engineering that are important. One of them, which is the obvious kind, is what's called germline genetic engineering. And that's essentially changing the sperm or the egg or the fertilized ovum to give a change that will be in every cell of every descendant thereafter. The other is the kind of genetic engineering which takes an adult person and you find ways of changing the genes in many of that person's cells. And that sounds impossible, but turns out there actually are ways of doing it. The trick, basically, is that viruses do that deliberately. That's how they spread, and it's possible to hijack a virus, to basically modify a virus so you're putting additional material in it, and then when it comes around the person, it's putting that additional genetic material on the person. And that there are a few fairly serious diseases. I don't know if you know the story of the bubble boy, the boy who basically had no immune system and therefore had to be brought into sick. Apparently that particular illness can be partly cured, though not perfectly cured, by after-the-fact genetic engineering, because it's due to a genetic flaw and they know enough about it. So, but either of those, you could certainly imagine a future where in some countries it said, no, that's against the will of God, or that's letting rich people get good things that poor people can't get, or for any variety of biological reasons banning it, but then there'll be other places doing it, and then there will be interesting connections between it, which all has to do with what people are doing. Other comments, questions? Yes. The point that I was making probably before you came in was, I talked earlier a little about trade and capital movements, but is that given that different societies are going to have different views of what technology they disapprove of, one of the things that's likely to be happening in your lifetime is that certain technologies are banned in the U.S. but developing in China or in India or somewhere, and that's going to be relevant to trade, that you're going to have people, as I was mentioning, happening already, people go off to India to have a host mother bear a child, which is legal in the U.S. Well, whether it's legal in the U.S. depends on what state you're in, actually. Similarly, you're going to have technologies developed in one country, and maybe another country objected to developing and isn't willing to ban it, or maybe they'll ban it, but you can still use it in the other country to produce something for here, so that part of the way in which the future is likely to be different is that there are various technologies which are developing in different places. Part of what's going to encourage that, I was arguing earlier, is that for the last several hundred years, pretty much everything that mattered was really European in terms of the civilization, and that's not going to get you anywhere. That the other old civilizations are coming back online. Each of them is going to have a different set of prejudices, a different set of cultural preferences, and you're going to be living with them. I think he wants to carry me away. So, anyway, things to think about. And